Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
A tete-a-tete was had. Yes, I looked it up. That means like one-on-one meeting. Private conversation or interview.
A secret conclave, if you will.
So yes. It's not a tot-a-tooting?
A tooting cat. No, it's a tete-a-tete. And Jason Quick and Brandon Roy sat down for one. Excited. This is like the, it was like the dangling carrot for all these years, wasn't it, for you?
Yeah, it sure was. I've been hunting this story for years. And I was just finally able to get enough time and space to go up there and track them down. And I was sure glad I did it. Actually, it's why I had to miss last week's shows, because I was up in Seattle visiting with Brandon last Thursday.
Well, he was just, you know, in all my years of doing this, I know you've been here longer than we have, but I mean, it's been 15, 16 years. I don't know if there was an athlete that I enjoyed more, or honestly, that was more important. I mean, Lillard certainly has done his share, but where this franchise was when he came along and what he meant to the city, I think he's really special.
No question, Suk. I mean, the time that he came into this franchise, I think he really rescued it from a lot of different angles. The fan base was fed up with what the Blazers were. They were the jailblazers. They were bad seeds, bad characters, and they were bad on the court. And people stopped coming to the games. I mean, it was 12,000, 15,000. And around that same time is when, you know, Paul Allen, there was starting to be questions about his commitment to the Blazers. The Rose Garden was up in bankruptcy. And there was if you remember, there was fear that Paul was going to move this franchise or sell the franchise and the Blazers would be no longer. And then here comes Brandon Roy and kind of this golden child with, you know, charisma off the charts, a really slick way of playing. And he was not only good in the community, but he was one of the most clutch players that I think I've covered. And, you know, he hit big shots, made big defensive plays, made big passes. And he had that gene of coming through in the clutch. And I think that really resonated. His whole package really resonated with this fan base who was thirsting for kind of a bright light in a dark era of this franchise. And he really pulled this franchise out of that dark time. And I think that's why he always has a special place in people's hearts on top of what he did on the court.
This is our Blazers insider, Jason Quick. If you're wondering why we're talking about this, he's finally put together the Brandon Roy piece. It is out. You can go read it on the internet. Is Brandon aware of what he meant to the city and what he represented here?
You know, I don't think so. I don't think to the depths and to the kind of emotion that people have for him. You know, he told me that as he was struggling from his departure from the NBA, he would try to turn on a Blazer game and he'd hear the announcer saying, "Oh, what a tragedy, what's happened to Brandon Roy," and he'd turn it off. And then he would kind of hear other things that, you know, he'd look and see that Damian Lillard has captured the city by storm. LaMarcus has become a franchise star. They're winning playoff series, which Brandon could never do. And that made him feel that, man, Portland, they're not even going to remember me. And that gave him a little bit of sadness and a little bit of detachment, I think, from the franchise. So I don't think he understands just how passionately and deeply this fan base, how they revere him. And I think he's if you're talking about a Mount Rushmore of Blazer players, I think he has to be on there. just because of how good he was when he played and what he meant emotionally for this franchise.
So when he was, you know, going, well, his knees were going south. He wasn't going south, but his knees were, yeah. And you mentioned all the surgeries. We all knew what was going on.
And it happened fast.
When that happened, he says there was a bit of a rift with the Blazers when things started to go south with his knees. Why was that? Describe that and what that was like, because we weren't privy to a lot of that.
That was probably the most surprising thing that came out of my interview with Brandon was his unhappiness throughout his final year in Portland. He felt that even if his knees hadn't totally broken down, that he was going to leave the Blazers, or that the Blazers were going to part ways with him. His frustration was that, okay, he ended up having to have double knee surgery that year in January. And when he came back, he felt like the team had already moved on from him. He remembers rejoining the team in Toronto, and literally nobody talked to him except for Jay Jensen. LaMarcus Aldridge was, as you know, kind of a to-himself guy. Andre Miller, very famous for being to himself. Wesley Matthews, very intense. They were in their own thing. They had been playing 30 games without Brandon Roy, and when the franchise player, the guy whose picture's on the side of the Rose Garden, came back, they had moved on and moved past him. And then when Brandon, it came time for him to be back in the lineup, he came off the bench and he thought Nate McMillan didn't play him enough. He only averaged 20 minutes a game, and he felt that he still had Brandon Roy moments in him, and that he could have, if he was allowed to play a bigger role, that they could have beaten Dallas in that playoff series. And it came to a head in game two of that playoff series. If you remember, he only played 8 minutes. And after that game, I kind of cornered him in the back hallway. And he said, I had to hold back tears on the bench. I couldn't believe that I had reached this point with this franchise. And he still felt like he had stuff in the tank. And he did, because 2 games later, he had one of the greatest moments in Blazers history when he had the 18-point fourth quarter and led him back from 23-point deficit. But that feeling of kind of the coach and the players and the franchise moving on kind of stung him a little bit.
How much of that do you think was the fact that they had just given him a bunch of money? Was there bitterness there, or was it a sense of everyone knew what was happening and it was almost like, let's move on, as opposed to, I don't know, trying to hold on to something that we know is ending, and it's ending quickly? Why did that happen?
Well, I think part of it is kind of the mentality of Nate McMillan. He's a big, next man up guy, and we're going to win with the players we have. He doesn't worry about the guys who are hurt or rehabbing or going through whatever. And so he push that thinking on the team, I think, that they were very tunnel vision and working toward making the playoffs rather than worrying about what Brandon was doing. And I think they had, I think that team won 54 games or something like that. They were a successful team. So I think he was like, what we've been doing is working. We don't need Brandon to come in and play a huge role. So, but as far as the money and stuff, Brandon told the story of the year prior, the 2010 playoffs, when he had knee surgery and then came back 8 days later and played in that playoff series against the Suns. You remember when he came in and they played the Rocky theme music and stuff? Before that game, when he was urging the team that he wanted to play, and Kevin Pritchard at the time said, okay, we just signed you to an $82 million contract. I need to get clearance for this. So he brought Paul Allen into the locker room, and they had a face-to-face, Brandon Roy, Paul Allen, and Brandon said, I want to play. And Paul said, okay, you think you can do it? And there was no hesitation of, hey, man, I just paid you a lot of money. I want to protect my investment. It was like, if you want to play, you go play. And so Paul gave him the green light to play on the knee 8 days after surgery. And, as Brandon Roy told me, looking back, he sleeps well thinking that he played it right, because he knew his knees were breaking down. And as he put it to me, he had to chase those moments. He had to, they were there and he had to go grab them. And he went after them anytime he could. That's why he did his knee surgeries both at a time the next year before the Dallas playoff series. He didn't want to do one knee and then the other knee like the team wanted him to, because he knew he'd be out for the playoffs. He wanted to get both knees done at the same time so he could get back and have that playoff moment. So, you know, he looks back and says, I played it right, because if I would have played it like the team wanted me to, I wouldn't have been able to have that game four memory of the fourth quarter against Dallas.
Well, he knew it. Athletes know it. He knew his body was failing him.
Yeah, and you know, he told me stories of he would get his knee drained 10 to 20 times a year, and they had a system where they knew that if they drained all the fluid out, it was too painful because they had the bone on bone. They needed to leave fluid in there to kind of lubricate and provide cushion for his knees, because he had had so many surgeries that all the meniscus and cartilage was gone. And he was able to tell how much liquid to leave in there because he got used to playing with his knees at a certain weight. There was a certain amount of fluid in there that had a weight. And so he knew by how much his knees weighed of how much fluid they were taking out. But, you know, he described that it was just a process to get out of bed and to the shower and, you know, eating all these anti-inflammatory. I remember always being by his locker and interviewing him, and they would come by and just flop down like this long stream of pills, you know, and the clear thing that you had to pop out of the back. And they were just anti-inflammatory pills. And just, it was like a magazine of bullets that they would just lay on his chair, and he'd take those home, you know? So it was a process, and he was going through a lot. And I think, you know, he told me one of his biggest frustrations about all this is that people didn't really fully realize what he was going through just to be able to get on the court and play.
So I've got so many more questions. Can you come back for another segment, or should we just pepper you with them now?
No, I can come back for another segment.
All right, I'm going to put you on hold. Thank you, Jason. This is Jason Quick, our Blazers insider. He wrote a long piece on Brandon Roy, caught up with Brandon Roy. And I do think a lot of Blazer fans, you know, are interested in this topic because there was never much closure.
No,
to
it's a really good, it's a long
how
piece
that ended.
It's really good.
So go check that out. And I want to ask him about the shooting. We don't know a lot about that. Brandon Roy, of course, got shot. And so he addresses that in the piece as well. We'll get to that next though. Stay right there. 3:46 on the Fan.
Prime Time with Isaac and Souk on 1080 The Fan.
Okay, we're smack dab in the middle of chatting with our Blazers insider, Jason Quick, who has done it again, a great piece on Brandon Roy, who's now, well, he has been, it remains up in Seattle. So, Quick, let's go chronologically. So the Blazers, it ends with the Blazers, and then we have the Minnesota thing where he comes back, and he says in your piece, he says, you know, look, he really needed to try that, and it showed him that it was over. And and he moves on. Why? A question I've always had about him was, we actually had a very good relationship with him here, and Souk and I have not had great relationships with athletes over the years. As a matter of fact, very few. But with him, we did, and a lot of it was him. Just he understood what we did. He was on our show a lot.
Listen to you guys. Still listens to you guys.
Is that right?
Get the hell out of town.
Yeah. Dude, he was...
Because he says he hears me on there, you know?
Yeah. Oh, he listens to us for you. Yeah. Okay.
No. That he said, I've heard you on the radio. Well, where else would he hear me on the radio?
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's hilarious. Well, we had a good relationship with him because we did a lot of remotes with him where we were face-to-face, and he came on the show for long periods of time. And Lardell, we had the old deal with his buddy Lardell, and they were just fun. Yeah. And they got what we did, and we understood them. And my question is, when he left here, and then even sort of after the Minnesota thing, it sort of felt like he had a grudge against a lot of his relationships here, the Blazers, Portland in general, and he sort of recoiled, and he just became reclusive. Why was that, or am I misreading that?
I don't think it had anything to do with Portland. It had to do with basketball and him being hurt and him losing his identity and trying to figure out, okay, now I've played basketball since I was six, and it's been my life, and now I don't have it, and it's not by my choice. I want to still play, but I can't, and it hurts. And he was depressed, and he was questioning who he was. He was going through all those things where he just didn't want to be out in public. He didn't want to watch basketball, be around basketball, be asked about basketball. So he kept to himself. And really, I mean, Brandon is a pretty private guy to begin with. I mean, he's great in public when he's and great in interviews and all that, but he's not an attention seeker. He doesn't like being out there, and he doesn't draw attention to himself. So at his core, he's kind of a to himself guy. But then when you threw the hurt and the frustration of having his career ended so early, and the mental pretzel that put him, that it created, that's why he kind of distanced himself and kind of holed up in Seattle for a couple of years.
Well, walk us through the process then. Like, is obviously, you know, I know not everything's hunky dory, but he does seem to be in a bit of a better place. And I know he went through the bad divorce in there, but kind of walk us through basically what he's been doing since.
Well, he didn't kind of come out of his shell until 2015. So it was pretty much two and a half years where he was just kind of a recluse and really struggled with it, didn't watch it. And even when his kids would say, "Daddy, is this really you?" And show him a highlight, he'd be like, "Yeah, but I don't want to talk about it." And it wasn't until 2015 that his son started asking more questions, and he kind of felt bad about it and wanted to start including them. And so he went down to Garfield, his old high school, and some of the guys were that he knew were running the team. And so he kind of started opening the gyms in the summer on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and just being in the gym. And he talked about the smells of fall and the smells of the gym, and just being around it again. He kind of started coming out of the shell and kind of realizing, hey, I've got to move on, and I've got to mature and accept this. And so it was around then, and then he agreed to coach. And I think that was a positive for him. He went to Nathan Hale, you know, the Porter brothers, who are very highly regarded, transferred there. He wins a state title. And a cool thing for him was to get joy from basketball. And he wasn't the one making a shot. He wasn't the one making the plays, but he still found that he got incredible pleasure from that. And he talked about winning that first state title and putting the trophy in his car, buckling it up and driving it to his house and then putting it on his couch. And just being immensely proud and happy. And he said he remembered sitting there celebrating with himself and going, "And I didn't do anything. I didn't make a shot or anything," and just looking at the trophy and feeling really proud about it. So I think that basketball kind of helped him, ironically, come out of his funk of missing basketball. But then he got shot, and that kind of reprioritized it made him kind of refocus what was important to him. And what is important to him was his family, his kids, because that's what he said he thought about when he was in the ambulance going to the hospital was, "Man, what if I died, you know, and what if I left my kids? That would be awful." So, but, you know, another important thing in there, in that time frame, is when he started coaching was right when he started his divorce from his high school sweetheart and the mother of three of his four kids. And it was a bad divorce, and he really struggled with it. And that combined with the high profile job of coaching Michael Porter Jr., who's now in the NBA, and the newness of starting to run a program, being a high school coach and going through the divorce, it really wore on him and stretched him thin. And then he got shot, and instead of really kind of taking time to to recalibrate and to recover. He kept pushing on, and he switched jobs and went to Garfield, his alma mater, and coached through that. And but it was a really interesting process because he felt a tremendous amount of guilt for being shot. And he said, look, you know, there's a stigma that comes with being shot, you know, that you're involved in bad stuff. And he said, I wasn't involved in any bad stuff. And he was really reluctant to talk about the shooting because they still don't know much about why, who, you know, the particulars of why it happened. And that scares him. He's like, I don't know if I was targeted. They don't think I was, but they don't know if I was targeted. So I don't want to be out here talking a lot about it and then have those guys, you know, be like, okay, we're not going to miss this time, you know? And so there, I think there was an element of fear with that. And this, an element of guilt that he didn't want his kids looking at him that, yeah, my daddy got shot. So there was a lot that he had to process and he didn't really take care of it. He thought he kind of had this machismo that, nope, I can power through this just like a player. I'm going to continue coaching. And he did, and they won a state title. But in the middle of that season, he was like, what am I doing? I'm going crazy. I'm going through this divorce, all this feeling of guilt and being scared, having these nightmares of dying. You know, he said he would wake up at night either gasping for air out of being scared or being just soaked in sweat. Because he had this reoccurring dream of the shooting, but each time he would die and it would just freak him out. His bed would be soaked. He'd have to go get towels and lay him on the bed. And it was a really traumatic experience, as you can probably imagine. So, all this was going on and he wasn't taking care of it. And, after he won his second state title, he went to the school and said, I need to take a year off. I need to worry about Brandon. And that's when he kind of recalibrated himself and started to get on this path towards happiness. And he was very clear to me to be like, look, Quick, don't make it out to be that I'm at this peak of happiness and everything's sunshine. That's not where I'm at. I'm on my way to that. I'm in a much better place right now. Things are looking positive. I feel like I'm in a place where I'm comfortable being back on the public stage. But it's been a process and he's had to go through things.
Yeah. Some of that's just age, you know, he's been through a lot, but you know, he's 35 now. So yeah, that's interesting. I guess I have to ask this question, but do you believe him when he says he doesn't know anything about the shooting or is that, I mean, is it possible that he knows more about what that was about than anybody else?
Oh, I suppose it's possible. I do. I mean, I tend to believe him. I mean, he was pretty, I felt like he was being forthright. That's my sense, but you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
I can't say for certain.
You think they're going to retire his jersey here?
I do. I don't have any indication from the Blazers that that's going to happen. But, you know, as I've said before, when they have a new player come, like Carmelo Anthony, for example, who wore number 7, when new players come to the Blazers and they're given the sheet of jersey numbers that they can choose from, number 7 is not included as an option for players coming to Portland. And that, to me, one, shows the respect and how this organization views Brandon. And I think it gives an indication that, hey, there are future plans for that number.
All right. Well, great job by you piecing all that together. It was really good.
Yeah. I encourage everyone to go read it. It's well done. Long piece and well worth the read.
And I'm sure there's way more that you couldn't fit in there. Maybe we'll get a part 2 or something, but great job by you. Go ahead.
Thanks. I'm actually working on that part 2 thing where he talks about his relationship with Andre Miller, with Nate McMillan. You know, another thing too, I mean, he's gone through 2 PRP procedures on his back he had degenerative knees. He also had a degenerative spine. And so he's had to have that twice. He ruptured his Achilles playing City League, men's league basketball. So his physical stuff hasn't ended. Yeah.
Well, if you talk to him again, tell him hi for us, because we actually really did.
Yeah, we enjoyed
I mean, that's
him
one
a lot.
Dude that man, we just liked him. I pull for him. I pull for him in any facet of life. He's a great dude.
He's a guy that is easy to root for and easy to respect. And I don't know. I just think he means a lot to the city and to Blazer fans. And it was just really cool to reconnect with him and to see him on his way to being in a good place.
Yeah. Hope he gets there. Jason, thank you.
All right.
What up, y'all? It's your boy Danny Green, 3-time NBA champ. You either rooted for me or rooted against me. Join myself and my co-host Harrison Sanford on the Inside the Green Room podcast.
It's a podcast that brings you never-before-told tales from the locker room to candid interviews with basketball legends to breakdowns of what's happening in the NBA right now. Whether you're a diehard fan or casual about your hoops, this podcast brings you the game like never before.
Follow Inside the Green Room on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.